Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today, we're going to be discussing an important topic, Ghanaian xenophobic attacks against Nigerians in Ghana. I'm joined by two very special guests. Our first guest is Professor Noah Echa Atta, Professor of African Economic History and Development in the Department of History and Diplomatic Studies, Federal University of Kashere, Gombe, Nigeria, and currently based in the National University of Lesotho. And our second guest is Yemisi Odlawale, a lecturer at the Department of History, University of Ibadan. Gentlemen, it's a pleasure to have you join me today, and I look forward to our conversation.
Thank you. It's my pleasure too.
Brilliant. Prof, Okay, great. Let me start from, it's a general question, but I'd like you to respond first. So we've seen in recent times, I think maybe July, around July this year, where we've seen some protests in Ghana where they've had a placard, Nigeria Must Go placard. Before we get to the historical, we know we've had history of Nigeria Must Go, Ghana Must Go. Before we get to the historical part, what is behind this recent agitation or protest?
Well, the issue is a multifaceted one, cutting across politics, economics, and social cultural dynamics. When we want to talk about the recent, the July 26 to 29, 2025 protests, Nigeria Must Go protests in Ghana. Was directly linked to a 2013 video which one Igbo king or head of the Igbo, whatever it might be, is the Ohazurume one, which he shared in 2013, and this time around, the same video was circulated where this Nigerian traditional ruler in Ghana discussed the plans to establish an Igbo village in Ghana. This video triggered reactions from the Ghanaian populace. Demonstrating that they were having the fear that, these Nigerians are encroaching traditionally and culturally and economically into into Ghana, and they are not trying to keep their boundaries as aliens. So that was the first thing that triggered the recent protest, but there are underlining issues. But before your next question, before we go further, there is something I always want to clear about historically. The position of the July issue was the case of protesters, unlike the 1969 aliens law in Ghana or the infamous 83-85 Ghana Must Go that were precipitated by the government. We must draw that line for us to understand the how this work out, because most of the time we lump everything together. Of course, there is no smoke without fire. There could be one or two influences of people in government, but the July protest was not government's position. Whereas the 1969 issue in Ghana and the 83-84 were government positions. Let me stop there for now.
Okay. Yeah, Mr. Let me come to you. we will touch on the historical bit and look at the level of the parallels. But before we come to that place, how credible are these the fears of the Ghanaian people in this research? Is it credible? Do they have a reason to fear, or is this just some sort of propaganda, or what do you think?
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you, Prof, for making the distinction about the protesters and the government position about xenophobia. Well, I always argue that the extent of the credibility is questionable. But one thing I can establish very well is that the xenophobic behavior of Ghanaians is rooted in the problem of integration. Okay, because Nigerians and all, not Nigerians alone, you know, Nigerians is just at the center of the event, just as the same way in the 1969 Alien Compliance Order, we always talk about the fact that Nigerians were the ones deported. So in this particular instance too, their credibility about economic domination, I think to a very large extent in my study of Nigerian presence in Ghana, is credible, okay? Because even by 1969, Nigerians dominated all the economic activities. And you know, the way xenophobic, which I'm going to discuss earlier, but mine is about, yes, it is credible. Their fears are credible. And their fears are rooted in economic forces. Okay, the economic forces of Ghana, which is the major thing drawing out the xenophobic behavior of the Ghanaians. So maybe I should stop with that before going into the history.
Okay, we'll come back. Prof, Yemisi mentioned something very interesting. So if you look at credibility, does not necessarily mean something that is some kind of a group of people can have a legitimate fear, but that doesn't make it morally right. So if we say what I want you to clarify for me from what you himself said is, now if someone feels like, if I hate using the word, but let me use it for, you know, if you say alien, some people have come from outside, and by virtue of their hard work or whatever, they're doing better than we are doing. So we feel threatened. But is that a fault of the Nigerians? Is that all the fault of the Ghanaian people to create? Or is it the fault of the Ghanaian people? Are they less ambitious? Or is that the fault of the Ghanaian government to create an environment that of that integration? Or whose fault? Where do we place the blame? Or how credible is this, a positive credibility or negative credibility? I think that's the right question.
Well, when we are talking about the credibility on the issue, the xenophobic attack of Ghanaians against Nigeria, we cannot draw a parallel with what happened in Ghana and what is still what happened in South Africa and what is still happening in South Africa. typically, Nigerians have this never die spirit. They are aggressive in whatever they pursue, be it in industry, be it in music, be it in economy, be it in education. They are always aggressive and dominant. When I was preparing for this, I was thinking that we'd be using the word aphobia. I think we should now migrate from aphobia to maybe Nigeria phobia, because Nigerians are being targeted. Not because they are not performing well, but to use this word in quote, because of their dominance, their host are not able to match with their capabilities, and as such, envy comes in. There are things we could tolerate as Nigerians. You can see, when you look at the economic, political, and social history of Nigeria, we've gone through a lot that Nigeria would have collapsed now, but we are still standing. And it's been said everywhere now that where you come and there are no Nigerians, you better leave that place. For the Ghanaians, their fears may be politically credible. I don't know if I am right to use that phrase. You know, when you are not doing well, you try to look for scapegoats. So Nigerians are being scapegoated in this xenophobic attack. And the people, the protesters, like I say, I don't want to use the government in this case. Of course, it follows the same line of argument that, okay, this is the hatred against this particular people. And this time around, you will recall, you will understand that the protest, the attack was against only Nigerians and not other immigrants. I don't know if I am right or wrong, but I've not read where other Africans were attacked, except in the past, in the 50s, in the 60s, we have all this across West Africa and even Africa. It is the failure of governance, and again, the poverty of leadership, perhaps, across Africa, not only in Ghana. And those in the political sphere would now want to point to or get a scapegoat to cover for their failure. Just as we have in Nigeria today, the government of the day is busy giving one excuse or the other for its own failure and blaming others or whatever for its own failure. I don't think that, that fear is legitimate. I was at the Nigerian diaspora meeting on Saturday. And we, at that forum, we discussed that the people here, they are not as aggressive, they are not industrious, they are not entrepreneurial as we are. And we're trying to introduce to them this, this Igbo, is it?
The trade, apprenticeship thing they do with the
apprenticeship. That we are going to do a program for them in order to live up to expectation. This is to mitigate open attack against us. There are opportunities. And I would have thought that we should take advantage. I mean, the Ghanaians should take advantage of the presence of Nigeria in Ghana. So, lately, what are they doing that we are not doing? How do we benefit from them? But to use the word of my late mentor and academic father, Mojo Echo in Ibadan, he said most of these people who are reacting are the wretched of the earth. In the Fanonian language. These are the never-do-well, perhaps dropouts, who do not have legitimate, traditional, or modern credentials to fare well in their whatever. This might be even outcasts. Of course, they are not different like from the area boys in Mushi, Ojuelegba, Marina, and what have you. What do you think such people would do? Those who sleep under the bridge or bridges. I'm just trying to draw this parallel, that the real people engage, I mean, take advantage of Nigerian businesses and entrepreneurs. So for me, the issue of credibility or justification for their action is, like Yemisi said, is questionable.
Prof, there's something you mentioned, I'll come to Yemisi, but let me go to Yemisi. Without taking agency away from this so-called wretched of the earth, we've seen it, you mentioned South Africa, without taking agency away from this so-called wretched of the earth, yeah,
yes.
The protesters. And you mentioned something also very interesting, how it is a question of political legitimacy and how the political elite also capitalize or manipulate the situation for their own gain. So in talking about that, I wanted to look at the broader. We see what's going on in not only in Africa, we see it in America with in the Donald Trump's administration. The xenophobic, you know, you see, there's this, we can't deny that, it's undeniable that it's part of this. The ICE actions are driven by race. We've seen it here as well. In the UK, we've seen this anti-immigration. So it's not just Africa. So what is going on? What is the, how does the Ghanaian case fit into the global apathy? Not apathy, but, you know, how would I put it, against immigrants? What are we seeing? You know, on one hand, we're seeing that the globe is expanding, but again, we're seeing a lot of protectionism. What is behind all of this? Can you speak to the paradox of that?
Yeah, it's just simple. I'm sorry to say on this platform, all these are coming up because of the crack in democratic apparatus. You understand me? Either we like it or not. You know, we have different civilization here and there. I've always talked to, accused historians and social scientists of fueling bad governance under the theories of what we have been taught in the school. Of course, we cannot hold on to something that is not working. Before I left Federal University, Kashere, we employed a young man who was my undergraduate student. When we employed him, Dr. Abdulkadri, I said, then I was the dean of the faculty. I said, my friend, don't come and teach these students introduction to economic history the way I taught you. Because between the period I taught him in 2000, perhaps 2005, this, but up to whatever. I said, I taught you what Ogunremi taught me, but I have come to understand better You understand me? Mm. Now, like you said, it's a global issue. And it is because they are trying to hide the crack in democracy.
I'm glad you speak well, say I'm that. I'm glad you say that because I'm currently editing a book. And looking at
there is need for us to how would I say, to re-examine the utility, the benefit of democracy. We had thought that democracy is not working in Africa. It's now open secret that it's not even working in the West. Because the basic tenets of freedom are being eroded. And mind you, Claude Ake had pointed out this crack long time ago. But you see, especially Nigerian academics, they are still holding on to this that, this is the best. Let us look for alternative. And it is this crack that is now, affecting other areas.
Prof, it's quite interesting that you mentioned. I think you have a vision into my book, and I'm actually my title of my old chapter is like Rethinking the Utility of Liberal Democracy in Africa. And then for you to say that, I've always questioned that, and I, like Riley said, even in the West, you can see the crack. Let me use the word. But let me come to Yemisi. Yemisi, How is the Ghanaian? I know from what Prof said, it looks like the Ghanaian government has maybe they've distanced themselves from this. So have you seen any? How has the Ghanaian government? Is there any formal response from either the Ghanaian government or the Nigerian government towards this recent stuff?
Well, the response of the government. I will also chip in two things from what Professor Noah said. You know, I was not scared about the protesters at the initial moment. But when we go back a little bit into history, the Alien Compliance Order of 1969, we will find out that it also started as a protest. And the protest was just like, we are having the cocoa price that's falling. And you know their economic hardship of Dr. K. Busia to implement the order. So I am particularly scared that even this wretched of the earth, they might be pulling some forces, which, well, I don't know because I'm not there in Ghana. Okay, but the way exclusionary policies works, you know, it always starts from the aspect of practice, exclusion in practice, before you now move to exclusion in programs. And the final stage of exclusion of aliens from a particular state, which is often discussed as deportation. So I'm always scared about that for that particular position. Then two, about the government. Well, Nigerian government diplomatically addressed the issue by saying that there is no cause for alarm, while the Ghanaian government distanced themselves. But we cannot know, you know, there is always an hidden and declared objective in foreign relations. So we cannot know to the extent the in-house idea of the Ghanaian government. Yes, because of state diplomatic relations, they are going to establish the fact that no, we are not going to do all this kind of deportation and alien thing. But
we see
we don't want people in government pushing for this. Okay, so it can be part of the broader picture of Ghana political. So that is my own position, sir.
We spoke about we keep, you know, the audience might not understand. For the audience who might not understand the historical precedents, Prof, do you want to explain the alien division policy of Ghana and then the Nigeria must go 83, 85 under, I think, was it Babangida or Buhari? That's one of them. Do you want to just give a brief?
Bagari in 83, then Buhari in 85. The truth is this. The 1969 alien I think July 17th or there, am I right? July 17th, no, not July 17th, November 17th, which was implemented on the 2nd of December, 1969, just few days. Obviously, during A.K. Busua's regime, after Nkrumah and the other military, and you know, Busia was brought in within a fragile political setup, and we understand that Nkrumah was overthrown within the period of a political and economic fragility in Ghana, especially due to the, what is it called, the falling cocoa prices. And it was telling on the people. And in order to make it as a smokescreen, to give legitimacy to the weak government of Busia, they try to find scapegoats in foreigners. Mark you, there should be another distinction. It was not only Nigeria. Other West African citizens were expelled. But what is it called? But Nigerian population was the highest at that time. I think numbering, there is this debate of maybe between 200,000 to 400,000. I'm not so sure now. And it just to embark on a populist policy, just like what Hitler did in Germany when he came against the Jews. That they were the root cause of German's problem. We can draw historical parallel with this. So, in order to be the government to be popular, and you know we are dealing with a population that is not well, I mean, not an articulated population, not a sound population. And they buy into this. I mean, they bought into this. Similarly, when we come to Nigeria, of course, what happened in 83, I was a participant. Because, you know, in those days, I had left secondary school and I was already working as a civil servant, earning good salary there. I started working in 1980 before going to the university, and everything was okay until the profligacy of what is his name? Shagari regime. People like Diko, people like Akinloye were just squandering our resources. And you know, all the military rules that have come in, apart from the early ones, the 66, they have always been, they had justification. And each time the military something came up, we all jubilated because the military men were smart enough to identify the problem in the country to tell us, oh, these people, this is the way. We saw it. We witnessed it. We felt the pain. So instead of addressing this major our economic issues which they created, I'm sorry to draw parallel again, because some people have accused me that I'm not a historian, that I'm a social scientist. I have been trained by Mojo Etong that you must make history relevant to the present, which is the philosophy of Ibn Khaldun. What happened then? The government now use it just to cover up and drop these people away. And I witnessed it. It was not the question of Nigerians against Ghanaians. It was the question of Nigerian government against Ghanaians. We had no problem with Ghanaians. They were the barbers in whatever. And I even knew a man doing very well under the Marina CMS bridge. Many of them, you see this quality hairstyle that our ladies are putting on now. For those of you who are younger than me, you may not know that it was the Ghanaian. The Ghanaians brought this, and some of this this braille was brought by the Chadians. Yeah. Why were the Ghanaians sent away? Why were the Chadians not sent away? Why were the Nigerians not sent away? Just to make a popular position. Like now, Trump has started something, American for America, and I mean, inflaming or instigating people. And this thing is spread across Africa. And you know, in Africa, we like copying things that are bad. Again, I want to make a point of correction. When they drove these Ghanaians away, some of us harbored them. And you know the hospitality of Nigerians. You can't take that away. I have never witnessed, of course, in Nigeria, especially if you are in Lagos. I don't know, because I live most of my life in Lagos. If you are in Lagos and a foreigner is around and a Nigerian is attacking, fighting a foreigner, be ready for a fight. From that Lagosian. And I think it's not too different. And if we don't have this communality, why do we have the French community in Ejibo? Why do we have, of course, that had also been affected in at a point in Cote d'Ivoire? Why do we have the Nigerian community in Cote d'Ivoire? We have the Ejibo people. Well, I think Yemisi, you did something along that line, I'm not sure.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I did, sir.
I think I came across one of your words on this Ejibo, whatever. And I am looking forward to somebody who will work on the Igbo people in Ivory Coast, who went there as migrants during the Civil War, and they have not come back up to today. Of course, they don't. I'm not sure they speak a word of Igbo today.
You know, Prof, I agree with you, and also being conceived and raised in Lagos myself, I understand how most of this is just a destructive policy. And that's why I was a bit surprised when you try to, but I'm not sure it was intentional, to remove the elite from this recent event. Because I'm like EMC Riley pointed out, the elites are always, their hands are always in any of those protests. Maybe not directly, but they always want to capitalize on it. But let me ask you, how does this situation that we see, how does it complicate the notion of the Pan-Africanism, especially now that the AU is talking about African solution to African problem, the African continental free trade? I think Ghana itself just made visa free for Africans, and I think Rwanda as well, and maybe Kenya.
Burkina Faso.
So, yeah. So how does this complicate all of that? All of this seems to be an irony. How does it complicate the situation?
Yes, thank you very much. July this year, I was in Ghana for an ECOWAS at 50 program, where I presented a paper on free movement policy. So in the process of discussing the free movement policy, the issue of 1969 and 1983 deportation came up. And Prof, well, my PhD thesis is also on Yoruba presence in Kumasi. You know, they were sent away in 1969. They came back to Kumasho and Yoruba land back there. And today they are an established community. So I'm trying to answer the question of integration level. Have they been integrated? Which definitely I'm going to provide answer. But what I'm trying to establish here is that this whole xenophobic of a thing affects African integration, okay? You know, the African Union just signed the African Continental Free Trade Agreement and to boost trade in the whole of the continent. And trade, like I said in my presentation there, that ECOWAS has moved from ECOWAS of state to ECOWAS of people. That is, this unification that you want to have among states cannot be facilitated by the president of the country. It is the people, those people in the informal economic sector, and the one that will carry their goods, move around to ensure that the principle of integration is achieved. So when there are xenophobic incidences in all these West African states, then there is no spirit of African unity. Okay, and you know, it's just like Prof said, we will not be qualifying different xenophobic activities with the name of different countries, Chadophobia, Burkina Faso phobia, and put it in that way, because everybody doesn't want another person to benefit. And when we are talking about economic integration, we are talking about bringing together human and material resources for the development of a part of a region and of a continent. So by the time you say you don't want Nigerians because they are dominating the trade, rather than what Professor Noah said, rather than you from learning from the tricks, then there is no spirit of integration. Then in last conclusion, I want to establish the fact that, well, my own research have shown that because when I go to Ghana, there is this discrimination of the thing, it's too much. Even as a researcher, I face it a lot, and you know, I have to off my glasses, off my cloth, because they will quickly recognize me as a foreigner, and you know, the way they react to me. And so someone asked me at the interview, when I was having an interview with one, and he told me that, don't I think that when they were sent away in 1983, it was a revenge of what happened in 1969? Well, I stand to be corrected, but for my own research, I established the fact that it was not a reappraisal. Were determined by because, you know, the fall in cocoa price, that's why they use the scapegoating. And the fall in oil growth also leads to us using it as scapegoating. But, you know, because the larger population always see it as the appraiser, and that thing has been fueling xenophobic agenda in everyone. So I don't know how to establish it, because till now, the larger percentage of Ghanaians believe it was a reappraiser. And they believe that Nigerians and Ghana cannot cohabit. And both of us are West African countries colonized by the British. So how do we promote, and even in West Africa, both of us are kind of giants. So how do we cohabit for the development of West Africa when two strong countries are against each other in terms of peoples and citizens, which make up the bulk of the foreign policy relation? So that's my submission. So it does not allow integration.
I just want to chip in something from what MEC had just said.
Yes, sir.
The relationship between Ghana and Nigeria predated colonialism. There had been this colonial trade between Nigeria and Ghana before colonialism. There had been a transborder trade between Nigeria and Ghana before colonialism. As we are talking today, there are Ghanaians who are Hausas. I think it's Northern Ghana or thereabouts.
Northern Ghana, yes, sir. Northern Ghana, Kumasi.
The present Ghanaian military had its root in Hausa's constabulary.
Yes, sir.
I think Dr. Wangpa said something while we were discussing, that from what we have been saying is just a product of manipulation by the elite. When I was in Ghana for a postdoctoral fellowship some years back, I think 2012 or 13, I can't, 12 or 13. My host, Auntie Irene, the director of the Center for African Institute, her daughter married to a Nigerian. And I don't know if YMC will know Abba Daladi, who was my student.
Abba Daladi, yes, University of Ghana.
Who was my student? He is married to a Ghanaian.
Yes.
Are you getting me now? that this thing actually may not reflect the social relationship or dynamics between the two citizens. I don't want to use the word country now. That it is elitist manipulation. But this thing, like I said, I argue somewhere that if we are not careful, when I was putting a proposal on this xenophobic whatever in South Africa, that this thing may morph into genocide. Look at what happened between the Hutu and Hutsi in Rwanda. It started gradually like this, and it was because of a political manipulation. Look at what is happening now in our dear country, Nigeria. Sometimes I'm not moved by, sometimes when they said, I am in a foreign land, I have my limitations here, and they do all sorts of things. But I normally tell my colleagues, I say, look, we have to be careful where we came from. What is it like?
It's true. I'm glad you mentioned that.
Because against ourselves.
I'm glad you mentioned that. Prof, let me, sorry to cut you short, but there are still some, there's something you and YMC have said. YMC mentioned, he said, ECOWAS, you move from ECOWAS of state to ECOWAS of the people. And then we're talking about states. But again, we're seeing something also in parallel with what's going on. We've seen it in Botswana, where the anti-colonial struggle party has fallen. We're seeing protests in Mozambique. We've seen in all of these places where the African youth seems to be distanced from that colonial struggle or that historical bit. They are more concerned about governance, about what is happening now. And they are the problem. We saw the NSAS protest led by the youth. We saw the finance, in Kenya. We are seeing youth, we see flashes of this. We see, all of this happening. Do you think we are getting to a place where the elite, again, we are seeing in Nigeria, like Riley said, where the elites are playing on our primordial identities, playing on, ethnicity and all of that. But alongside that, we're also seeing these newer forces, these youth that are not thinking like that. Do you think that is a force that will definitely challenge and change this system? Do you see that hope? With the Senegalese president, we saw the youth president in Senegal. I think it's the youngest one. We see this military guy in Burkina Faso. I don't believe military has anything, because military itself didn't play any role in African independence, but they've always acted like savior. So I'd never believe that the military can play any role, no matter how good intention they are. But we're beginning to see all of this stuff. Do you see hope, is what I'm saying, where the African youth can change the system?
Well, we can see hope somewhere, and we cannot see hope in other places. Africa, we cannot lump African countries together in this scenario, in the sense that the Nigerian youth, speak from both sides of the mouth, depending on the patronage they receive. I remember in my high school days, in the 70s, for the fact that the food in the dining hall didn't taste well, we went on riot. You remember the Ali Must Go, historically, in 78, Ali Must Go.
Yes, sir.
The elites have been able to capture the youth. And now, while we are talking about the poverty of leadership in Nigeria, the thesis on the poverty of leadership is becoming obsolete. We should now look at begin to investigate the poverty of followership. These are people who are suffering. The weaponization of poverty has subdued people to the extent that they cannot decide meaningfully. Whoever puts bread on their table, just 5,000 is enough for them to change their mind. You remember what happened during the last, when some clergymen, bishops, or fake bishops came up. How do you account for that? How do you make progress with that? Then you remember even in academic parlance, whereby we ethnicize scholarship. You now discuss depending on where you are from, depending on your ethnic affiliation. So we have a complex issue in Nigeria. It may work in other places like Senegal, but the way Nigeria is now, it cannot work. And because of that, now the so-called elites from the different background, ethnic backgrounds, they are in unity against us. I can't imagine Remi Tinubu. I can't imagine Remi Tinubu sitting down with the widow of Abacha in Kano. June 12th, I witnessed it. I lived in Surulere. I was held up in Antony for 3 days. And I had to trail from Antony through Mushi, through Inupeju Mushi, before I could get to Surulere. And these were the people in the forefront of political agitation. So I'm not saying we should not have the spirit of forgiveness. I'm not saying that. We can, but when somebody has not come to apologize or be held responsible, there is a big question. They now jettison, what is it called, the interests of the people, and uplifting their own interests. All of them, put them together. They are either from east, west, south, or they are the same. As far as I'm, there could be pockets of them, but in the minority. In the National Assembly, who can you say that, okay, we stand for the masses? It's a big issue. And what they now do is to look for who is speaking against them, to buy them over.
You're very, Prof, let me agree with you to some extent. I sometimes look on the social media, and I know one particular person. He's a young guy. Before I traveled, I brought him, he was assisting me in the program I was doing in Unilag. And he had a very objective, but now I see him. And you can clearly tell that this person has been bought, maybe giving some money to try to lauder the image of the current government. And these are people that are really suffering under the current government. And these are the youth. So I understand when you say the poverty of followership. But again, I also want to see them as not taking agency from them. I also want to see them as I want to hold, in my last book, I don't know if you've seen it, I wrote Nigeria's Fourth Republic, a Militarized Democracy. That's my last book. And one of the elements that I identified as going to change the continent is the youth. And I have great hope in that. And I hold educational system, and the academics are to be blamed. Because I know in the, I wasn't young enough, in the late 80s, 90s, I go to meet my brother in the university. Like Raleigh said, you guys had access to even food in the university. You had all of that. These were solid academics. teaching with, but now we have academics that are not, that are graduating thousands of or millions of on critical youth. So I don't want to put the whole blame on the youth, on the followers, but also put it on the academic side that are not teaching or raising. So that's my, so I wanted to comment on that.
You see, you cannot, there is this saying that when you have somebody with hunchback and the load on his head is not, his or her head is not stable, you have to look downward. He's, for me, I'm not saying this because I'm part of the academy. It appears the academics to have been reduced to a situation that they cannot help themselves. As a, who are those being recruited into academics? Who are they? I was speaking with one of my former students. Was it this week? We're discussing, it's long time we discussed. He said he got a new job in Abuja. He's an activist. And he started recollecting that my Marxist disposition in the class, this and that, my, that every person knew where I was going. Today, the academy has become amorphous. Amorphous in the sense that now you look at some it's not peculiar to Africa or Nigeria, it's even abroad. When you see some dissertation now, you don't know where to start. You don't know where to rate it. And incidentally, the person becomes what? What is it called? Becomes a PhD holder. Later on, you hear he's a professor, professing nothing. I won't mention the university. I was supervising three PhD candidates. Not in my own university. I was supervising three PhD candidates. And three of them at different whatever, from an elitist university. Oh, they said they were coming to meet me in Gombe. And I said, no, you don't have to meet me in Gombe. That I stopped, the last time I supervised a student face-to-face was 2008. That you don't need to come. Oh, they say, prof, they need to come. And say, I said, no, I'm not the type of person. Just send your work to me. I think one or two sent their works to me. By the time I asked them to do this, do that, since 2022, they never got back to me. I try reaching out to them. You understand? I try reaching out to them. Oh, I'm not. They ignored my call. They ignored my emails. And I have to leave them. And I just concluded that, well, Atai has not, I'm too old to fall into that type of trap. And today, the university system, now you find out that there is no due process in recruitment of people. Sometimes you will sit down as a head of department or a dean, and they will just send somebody from Abuja to come and resume. You will be wondering, you somebody you did not interview. All this happening because of the manipulation of the politicians. So, and the same people, when we are talking about ASUU strike, I didn't know how I survived during the 8-month strike. It was after the 8-month strike that I have to come here and say, no, I can't go into retirement under this condition. I will just die early. Yeah. So, and I have to come down to this. Most of them, most of our professors, those ones with integrity who have no opportunity in governance, being employed, they are dying. I'm sorry to say that. I'm not sure he will remain too long in Ibadan.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I'm sure he's putting his things right there. Okay, how do I move? Yeah. How do I get a better environment?
I agree. And that brings us to, because of time, we will barely have about just 5 minutes. And I'll just follow up on that. So for us to look at, because again, when someone tells you, when you come to someone's house and they tell you they don't want you, sometimes you look inwards, and inwards is what we're talking about now. We're talking about our own problem, because people will respect you based on how where you're coming from, how solid your moral lens is, or whatever it is. So speaking of that, let me ask both of you this question. Just use 2 minutes. We have just 5 minutes. Yeah, Missy, let me start from you. Okay. How do you see how we can correct this xenophobic manifestations in Ghana, in South Africa, in these other places, both internal and external? How can we address this? And what agencies can address this?
Okay, let me just, there are several ways, but let me just pick up like two in the next 2 minutes. One. I work on the paper of suspension of state data in the Niger Republic, and the citizens are jubilating, okay, because of the in-depth of poverty in this particular state. The coup is not really about the military coup. It is about the economic state of the country, and not only the state, all over Africa. So every state government, you know, this problem of corruption, I don't want to go into that. Every state government must return to the table and look inward for how economic development, sustainable ones, can be pursued. Okay? Because unless these things are pursued, we are just there. So, and you know, the xenophobic of a thing, they are reigniting the spirit of Africa, is very, very important. And we have to go like one of Buhari's, President Buhari's agenda, which I love so much, that change begins with me. Okay? That change, everybody must adopt this idea. That change between with you and I. So if change begins with you, you have to do things in the right way, think in the right manner of integration and African development, not the other way. So rather than fuel xenophobia, you have to look inward and look at how you can collaborate with aliens and migrants towards the development of Africa, not individualism in this particular respect. So that's okay. My position.
Brilliant. Prof, 2 minutes to you.
Yeah, the basic thing I want to say, mentioned it, and I just want to emphasize it. And that is my position, that the push factor that pulled Nigerians out of Nigeria should be looked into. If your home is good, you won't go to another person's home. It's only a little percentage, like people who are itinerary or migrant traders that want to move from one place to the other, like the Ogbomosho people, you understand, like the, maybe to some extent, the Ilesha people. My argument is that let the home government make their country, let Nigerian government make the country livable, sustainable. That is my own take on it. Once it's good, you don't need to go out. Well, those of us who are outside, we want to be at home, to eat amala, to eat fufu, to be connected with our family members from time to time. We have that filial feeling. So if you agree with you, no person will go out.
Another thing again I'll add to that is, if the home is good, it's not even about going out, other people will respect you.
We come. Thank you.
Respect
you. Just as the Ghanaians came in the 70s.
Well, unfortunately, we're running out of time. We've got a few seconds. Then I really appreciate, you know, your deep insights into this conversation, and I share the same sentiments, and I look forward to a continent that is free of unnecessary hatred, envy, and state capture, state manipulation. And wish prosperous continent. Anyways, we have to go now, and I wish you the best. Thank you very much, and have a
good day. Thank you. Thank you, Professor. Yes, sir. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. I will reach out to you, sir.
Okay, please do.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode. As usual, join me to thank our guests, Professor Atta and Yemisi Olawale, for their brilliant assessment of the xenophobic attack in Ghana and broader, wider issues on the continent. For now, stay blessed and I'll see you soon.